My name is Evan White, and you're listening to the Stories on Stage Davis podcast. This holiday season doesn't look like the last one. We're hearing every day about the rise in new cases of the coronavirus and about how important it will continue to be that we keep practicing social distancing. For many of us, this meant holidays separate from loved ones, or maybe Thanksgiving dinners over Zoom. This year has certainly come with challenges. It can be difficult to remember the things we've been given when we've had to let go of so much, but one thing we remain thankful for are great stories like the one in this episode. At the risk of editorializing, I want to say how excited I am personally to present writer David E. Yee and his story, Heaven for Your Full Lungs, read by Brandon Nakagaki, who is making his debut with our series. I first read Heaven for Your Full Lungs in the summer of 2017. It had just been published in American Short Fiction, and in the time since, whenever I'm asked about favorite short stories, it's almost always among the examples I cite. I say this because it's a story that carries you deep inside another kind of world, which is my favorite sort of story, and the kind of story many of us may be hankering for at this point. David E. Yee's work has been widely published and celebrated, and I encourage you to stay tuned after the story to hear him talk about the inspiration behind it. But first, here's Brandon Nakagaki reading David E. Yee's Heaven for Your Full Lungs.
Heaven for Your Full Lungs by David Yee. When I surface, I fold my blazer over the edge of the tank, rip the left sleeve off my dress shirt, and use it to tie the mass of hair behind my head. The shoulder of the linen had been torn in my fall, so I don't mind ruining the garment. But I shouldn't have forgotten my hair ties, not for a formal gig. This is after I've coughed the night-thick water from my stomach, that final heave like vomiting. Then I sink, forearms holding me to the lip of the glass walls that form a square around me. 10 by 10, transparent but sturdy, like the bulletproof slabs bank tellers work behind. For a moment, I can recall the sensation of being in a pool early in the season, how you have to descend into the water for warmth. I blink my eyelashes dry, and by this time, Benji has heaved out his minestrone in the tank adjacent to mine. I stand and say, "Tell me I'm pretty," and he chuckles. "Tell me I'm fun." I climb free of my death and join the others doing the same, balancing on the edge of the glass as I climb over it. I can see the other vessels, identical to mine except for their contents, stretching out and blurring together in the distance. Before I jump down into the narrow channel of white tile that forms a grid between the tanks, I remember those nights when, as a teenager, I'd sneak out over the backyard fence towards Jerome's warehouse apartment. I'd learned to play the drums while he figured out his off-brand Telecaster. That memory is so far away now, a song I only know half the words to. I take Benji's hand, gripping his armpit to help him over. He says, "Thanks, Thump," as he brushes chunks of pasta and carrot from his tank top and boxers. He died in the Bolton Hill apartment he used to share with his cousin, had a coronary event while eating soup, fell face first into it, paralyzed. He'll always be 41. He said once, while he rubbed the thin spot on his scalp, "At least I shaved that day. Can you imagine? An eternity of stubble?" We go to my catty-corner neighbor, Roberta, and ease her over, the wet ends of her hair threading the wrinkles on her back. She'd slipped as she settled into the tub at her old folks' home, has a jagged scar on her temple and a bruise in the shape of a rose on her lower back. Benji cleans himself in her tepid bathwater, lapping it over the glass and onto his limbs. Usually, Benji and I walk together. Some days, we split up. Occasionally, I stay in and list on my back in the water, dark as the sky I drowned in. My first waking while I was thrashing around, Benji came to the edge of my tank, and he said, "It's okay. You're okay now." I must have looked like a swamp creature, the black coils of my hair cascading wet across my face. I was still calling for help. Benji asked where I'd been. My nostrils burned, my throat raw from the coughing. I'd been on a boat, No, a yacht, with strings of light suspended between lattices on the bow. I remember looking up at them while I played, charmed by the way their yellow glow made the chrome of my drum kit shine, the stripes in the maple darkening in contrast. Jerome had just finished some banter with the audience, and we started Beast of Burden. It was Jerome's idea, playing for a wedding band, earning steadier money, and I went along because I could barely make rent and it beat waiting tables on the weekend. After the set, I got too drunk and fell overboard. I don't know how long I was treading water, shouting, "Wait!" until my throat ached. The chill of the sea wind caught me in the back of the mouth. 20 feet off, the boat, swollen with light, bobbed with the current. I'd considered myself a capable swimmer, but after 10 strokes, I knew I couldn't match its pace. When I tried to float, panic made my breath unsteady. On the deck, the music had been so loud the cones in the speakers popped with the kick, but from the water, I couldn't tell the tempo of the song, slurred by the distance. It was hard, wanting the hands of the world to catch me, to slow the ship, to pull my body from the Chesapeake and return it to the party. When the yacht was just a speck, a murmur on the horizon, I was alone in the water. As I kicked off my Oxfords to shed some weight, I knew there was nothing watching over me. That first time, Benji listened to a less concise retelling, nodding as I described the feeling of slipping under, of reaching above my head and feeling only more of the bay, the bitter taste of the murky water as it eased past my tongue. Then, the terror of surrender. He'd said, "Well, it's all over. I'm Benji." Running my fingers over the surface, I was confused by the cube of the Chesapeake that encased me. I reached out to shake his hand, said, "My name is Theodore. Everyone calls me Thump." He'd been right. Though I was soaked from my scalp to the soles of my feet, I felt calm, restful even. There are no burdens for the dead. Is there a need to fret about what you can't remedy? Today, like that first day, we greet the people drowned around us in our, for lack of a better term, neighborhood. The language of life falls short here. There are no days. We talk and explore until we wake again in the liquid that carried us here. It happens in a moment. Trying to recall something specific, like the smell of your apartment, the tone of the air as cars whip past on the cross street, and when the memory falls away in a laugh at the end of an anecdote, or the eyes-closed exhale punctuating a private thought, there is a lapse, a lightheadedness, a release and submersion. Then, the sudden desire to breathe. I fold my blazer on the edge of the tank, rip off my sleeve, tie the mass of hair behind my head. Every single time, I hate the briny taste of the Chesapeake as I purge it past my throat. Lowering myself in the water to my chin, I wait for the shivering in my flanks to ease, and when I can see again, Benji is smiling. I rise and say, "Tell me I'm pretty. Tell me I'm fun." I help him over, then we free Roberta, and she says, "Such lovely gentlemen you are." Her skin smells like lavender soap, the kind my mother kept in the half-bathroom growing up. No one understands how long each cycle lasts. The order of our cells is untraceable. We don't busy ourselves with figuring it out. Instead, we climb into the channels and converse like actors after a show, discussing our lives as if they were a performance. For every suicide, there is an accident. For every murder victim, a failed rescue. Someone told me once that stories here aren't just currency. They're our blood, our breath. It is entirely possible to avoid change, to gather your former wants, wishes, and regrets into one neglected place in your mind and spend your time socializing with the dead around you. But when you share something personal here, people listen, and there is motion to that, a slow kind of unburdening. Benji says, "You know, a lot of musicians end up drowning. I have a theory. What makes a musician if not a love of rhythm? Every instrument is some kind of vibration, My cousin used to play this clarinet with a messed up mouthpiece, and her reed just buzzed and buzzed, drove me crazy. But anyways, every musician I've ever met, all the real ones, they can't get away from rhythm. Always tapping their feet or bobbing their heads. They need a pulse, and water has one. I mean, it's never really still, right? He holds his hand between us, swaying. Maybe it draws you guys in. You know Art, the saxophonist? He's around here somewhere. He'll back me up on this. Today, I lead our walk, turning left past cells of miniature lakes, pool water fuming chlorine, so many oceans lapping at the tips of their containers. A woman with mud in her dress reaches over into a lukewarm bath, submerges herself like she's bobbing for apples, and comes up with a baby, pale bottom held in the crook of her arm. Benji touches the crown of its head as it cries the fluid from its lungs. He says, "Hi, Jessica." She says hello, patting the child on the back. Then the baby is serene, smiling with a finger in its mouth. And Jessica says, "There, there." Conversations about drowning, about death, always turn personal. I don't usually offer the more precise details of that night, but this doesn't stop Benji from asking about them. Benji says, "Were you a drinker? I mean, did you always get drunk at gigs?" I told him sure, because the guys and I used to get after it, but this was rowdier than usual, because I had gotten into a fight with my girlfriend, Andy. Benji stops a moment, looking at me like he's noticing for the first time the color of my eyes. He says, "She's always the first thing you bring up. Did you love her?" And he's so close to shaking with passion as he asks that, I can't help laughing. He says, "Don't be like that, it's a serious question." I say, "It's hard to recall. Spent a lot of time wondering what she saw in me. She was sharp in a way that made me uncomfortable and yet excited to talk to her. God, the way her face bent when she laughed at me. That posh haircut. Her olive skin. You know, she used to call me Chopstick. She's the only one I'd ever let get away with that." After a while, my clothes dry out. Benji puts his hand on my shoulder. "What'd you fight about?" We turn and turn again, stepping slowly across the damp tile. There's no reason to remember your way back. I say, "It feels weird now how much we made out of nothing. Jerome had booked that Rock the Boat gig on the bay, and it paid shit, but he negotiated a plus one for everyone in the band. We figured we'd just party. I'd been with Andy for 3 years by then, but Jerome had barely settled down, was still jittery about everything being just so. He got annoyed I had my hair down, but my hair ties were back in the car and we'd already set out. I figured he'd get over it. Andy and I snuck off after the second set. I say, she used to lead me by the hand to those off-limits places. She was confident like that. I'd never go myself." Benji pauses at a crossing, saying, "Oh, maybe you would've. You were young." We went through the kitchen to this back room where they kept seating for the deck. I could taste the Merlot on her lips. Could see the tint of it on her front teeth. She sat on a table, brought me to her. "I wish I could have gone there. Just dropped dead. That would make for a nice afterlife." Benji laughs. "I don't think it works quite like that. Sometimes I check my pockets for a misplaced hair tie nestled in a divot of cloth. My pants and jackets used to be full of them. I fold my blazer, rip off my sleeve. Steve, my neighbor on the other side, is a child, says gosh, as he blows the green mud from his nose into his creek water layered with dead leaves. Then he jumps free and takes off running. Benji and I have spent a few days walking in different directions. I smile to him. "Tell me I'm pretty. Tell me I'm fun." Roberta says,
"Thank you, gentlemen."
We join a group of men and women using their arms to spin the Johnson & Johnson bubbled water of a tub nearby, swirling an infant from the middle and into the hands of a man named Bon, whose hairy chest has flecks of puke in it. Benji waves, and Bon uses the baby's hand to wave back. "We need to find a guy named Wilhelm," Benji says. Everyone keeps talking about how he passed out in a kiddie pool filled with champagne. I ask him if he liked the taste of it enough to search it out. He says, "In life? No, not really. I never was a drinker. I guess that's why I didn't get invited out much. Or maybe it was the other way around." The skin on his forehead goes taut as his brows pinch the shadows around his eyes. He says, "Who's to say now?" We start down a channel of Indonesian families reuniting, men and women pulling their children, their neighbors, from the cloudy water, wiping debris from their foreheads, pressing ears to chests. We've come this way before, but the fervor of their affection at every waking surprises me still. Benji and I died in the same city, around the same time, but in life, in Baltimore, both rooting for the O's, I never knew him. He delivered mail, had a cat named Ralph, and watched award shows because he liked to see hard work get recognized, like the way elation looked on the winners' faces, naked and tearful. I ask him, "Why'd you become a mailman? What's that matter?" "I'm curious." He stops, wringing out the hem of his shirt, and says, "It paid well. Well enough that I could get by just living with my cousin. Even put some money in savings. I didn't want to be one of those people working two jobs and never having a life." When I try to get a glimpse of his face, he starts off in a different direction. I say, "So you got into it for the money?" "No, no, it wasn't that." He turns again, looking both ways at an intersection, searching the contents of each pool we pass. He says, "When I was a child, my mother would have these long conversations with everybody on the block. The milkman, the mailman, the women who worked at the laundromat below our apartment. She sat on the stoop giving out cigarettes to anyone who would stop long enough to smoke with her. It was lovely. Around Christmas time, she'd bake these thick sugar cookies for her friends. They were like little bricks. Tasted just awful. Children in swimsuits bump into us as they run through the channel. The youngest girl turns to apologize, and Benji smiles, says to run along. There is something diminished in his eyes, so I pat him on the shoulder, my fingers grazing the damp strap of his shirt. "No sign of champagne," Benji says. Then, "Surely there is someone here you're dying to meet." He grunts a laugh at his own joke. I touch my fingers to the surface of an ocean. "Just Buckley, that singer I told you about." Benji furrows the skin on his forehead. I say, "He had this song, Everybody Here Wants You. I used to sing it to Andy sometimes. Can't say I know it. I'd sing it for you, but my falsetto is shit. She liked it, though. It was the perfect song to tease her with. Guys were always hitting on her." "In front of you?" "Yeah, I mean, lanky Asian dude with a top knot, drumsticks poking out of his back pocket. I'm not imposing. The kind of guys that came to our shows were pretty forward. I know what they were thinking. Oh, she's with him. Must be because she hasn't met someone like me." We stop next to a pool of salt water that's so clear it makes me thirsty. Benji looks me up and down. I can tell he's comparing himself to me, so I don't make eye contact, just drum triplets on the edge of the tank with the knuckles of my forefingers. I'd be lying if I said I never let it make sense to me, Andy's relationship with me being a momentary stop on the way to settling down with someone who looked like her. "But she used to just fuck with these guys," I say. This one time, backstage, a dude sat on the other end of the couch, me on one side, Andy in the middle. He starts asking her about her work, where she lives, these first date questions. Her hand was on my knee and everything. This guy didn't catch on, or chose not to. I'll never forget. He asked her about the last place she traveled to, and she said, "Maui." And then she leaned over to me, basically shouting over the music. She said, "Remember that? That was the time you took a shit on my chest." "Wait, you did what?" "Jesus, she was just fucking around. Come on, Benji." "Well, I don't know. Do I look like that kind of person?" "What does that kind of person look like?" Okay, good point. But that's not what's important in this story. This dude couldn't hide his shock, but he tried to make like the comment hadn't bothered him. He leaned over, said, "Oh, I've been to Maui. It's very pretty this time of year." "Tell me I'm pretty. Tell me I'm fun," Roberta says.
"Not today. I could use a soak."
We smile, then go save that baby. And another.
We follow the crowd that gathers to free those who can't do so themselves. Then I get bored and take a left when everyone else goes right. And Benji says, "Do you and Andy fight often? Were you one of those couples?" I didn't think he'd follow me, but I tell him no. And then I'm steering and I keep straight. We nudge by a group of women with big hair and torn dresses, step by a row of children in loose-fitting Super Bowl t-shirts. It wasn't anything groundbreaking either. We just had a fight. Then I drank too much. If I weren't so tall, I'd probably still be alive. When I came off the stairs, I slipped and the rail hit me in that part of the thigh where the nerves bundled together. Benji doesn't know what I'm talking about, so I punch him there, and his leg stiffens. While he kneads out his muscle with his knuckles, I think about hanging out after band practice, Jerome and me fucking around trying to dead-leg each other. Every few intersections, Benji edges like he wants to turn. I feel like going forward. We find him leaning against a tank, brown hair slicked back, boxers slung low across severe hips, his dirt-soaked clothes draped across the glass. I'm not quite sure it's him before we stop at his shoulder, but I say, "I'm a big fan." Benji says, "You are?" He shakes Benji's hand, then mine. He says, "It's been a while since I got recognized." I say, "This is Jeff. Jeff Buckley." Benji smiles and nods, but I can tell he doesn't remember our conversation, so I say, "The singer we were talking about." "Oh, the one you wanted to meet," he says. "Thump says your songs are beautiful. I'd love to hear one." Buckley had been adjusting his underwear following the awkward volleys of our conversation. He says, "Unfortunately, I'm retired. What are you two gentlemen up to?" "We're looking for a man who drowned in champagne," I say. The three of us glance down the length of the row, but there is no brass fluid glowing in the glass of a vessel. "Well, tell me about yourself," Benji says. "It's always nice to meet new people." Benji still smells like tomatoes and salt. I squirm at his eagerness, and it's been so long since I practiced embarrassment that it feels unnatural. Jeff scratches at his head, saying with a chuckle, "I didn't realize how little I missed being interviewed." "What's the harm in sharing a story or two?" Benji says. "I love hearing about other people's lives. What else are we supposed to be doing around here?" Benji raises his hands, palms up between them, then lets them fall to his side. "You remind me of my uncle." Jeff looks at his bare feet, shins still caked in Mississippi River mud, and says, "He used to gather all my cousins up on holidays when he'd had a few and tell us stories, even if we didn't want to hear them. This one fable, growing up, I thought about all the time. I tried to write a song or two about it, but nothing panned out." Benji asks if he can recall it, and Jeff stares somewhere above my shoulder. He says his uncle was in Vietnam, had fallen in love with a woman there, used to sneak away from base to stay with her when he wasn't out on patrol. So, while they fended off sleep, she told him fables about her village. At the dinner table, after the food had been cleared, Jeff's uncle would get drunk and retell them, rubbing his swollen knuckles with the bottom of a Budweiser. There are many stories, but Jeff's favorite went something like this. In the mountain above our village lived an old, radiant tiger, and we'd learned to hate it for its beauty. When the sun rose above the peak, shining over us, the tiger left its canopy and walked among our crops, its fur swollen a brilliant gold in the light. Legends say that the cat was ancient, preserved in its health by the power of the sunlight. In recent years, the harvest had grown thinner, and our men blamed the tiger, saying its pelt stole the sun's nurturing. Our elders told us the tiger was part of the village, that they'd settled in this land at the time of its birth. The tiger had protected our land from invaders in surrounding lands. But as we grew hungrier, a group of warriors gathered and stalked the mountain. They trapped a tiger in a cave, made a wall of spears and torches. Cornered, the tiger fought its way to freedom. But the next day, the survivors gathered again, chasing the injured cat to a cliff, and still it clawed its way back into the forest. On the third day, the last of the men assembled to hunt, and the elders begged them to stay, that they shouldn't risk their lives. As they argued, the tiger lumbered into the village center, its fur streaked with wounds. In the ensuing battle, it killed half the remaining warriors before they got a spear into its heart. The children dug a grave along the river delta, and before nightfall, the cat was buried When the next harvest arrived, the rice grew thicker, the fruit weighed down the branches. We rebuilt, wondering why the sun had chosen to bless the tiger and allowed us to starve, wondering what we had lost by killing it. The three of us stand in a triangle. Benji rubs his hand on his chin, saying, "The splendor of nature. We were always destroying it." "I'm not sure that's the moral of the story," I say. "The tiger was part of the village." "So what do you think it means?" Buckley sets his elbow on the edge of the glass, and the contact sends a ripple across the brown river. "They were in need, so they blamed the part of themselves they didn't understand, the part of the village they no longer saw the use in, even if it was essential in defining them," I say. "They thought the tiger was doing them harm. It was easy for them to hate it." In the distance, I can hear someone splashing, and farther still, a woman calls out a name. Benji crosses his arms over his belly, and Buckley turns his back to us, leaning against his tank. I know I didn't pay enough attention to find my way back here. I know I will never get to ask him the questions that, in life, I would have gotten the answers to. But as I stare into the mire, I can't stop picturing the children digging that grave in the delta, their tan hands caked in earth, the sun setting fire to their black hair. So much like mine. There's an instant before my body rises, before I break the surface and my throat clutches for air, when I am lying on the floor of my tub, hugging my knees to my chest, all that dark water above. Here, I am closest to life, clinging to that final breathless moment when my body gave out. By then, my brain was barely firing, the capillaries in my eyes ruptured, and in those explosions, I didn't see a grand image of my life, only the yellow lights dancing in the paint on my drum kit, Jerome's feet pigeon-toed about the microphone stand, Andy in the audience looking out across the bay, bobbing to the rhythm. Any movement would buoy me to the surface, so I keep still. Benji beats his fist to the edge of my pool. I can hear him call, "Thump!" His voice deadened by the water. When he leaves, I concentrate on the image of Andy, her brassy hair tossing about her. We'd been friends since elementary school, but the night we got together, we were dancing in a Baltimore club. Growing up, I found her so charming, but until that moment, swaying through the night in celebration of her latest breakup, I hadn't mustered the nerve to do something about it. On the boat, Jerome's voice was jaw and whiskey, doing his best, Mick Jagger, coming out of the PA over my shoulder. The night was hot, and my thumbs were slick against the drumsticks as I dug into the hi-hat. The balls of my feet bounced on the pedals. I kept the band leashed to the back of the beat, driving through the chorus. As I raised my arm and whipped my wrist towards the crash, the song drifting back into the verse, the joint-loosening joy of life tipped in me, and I could feel every stomped foot dancing in the crowd. Every inch of the yacht shaking, every sway of the Chesapeake compelled by the beat in my kick drum. The set ended, and before I could start packing up, Andy said, "Come on, handsome." She grabbed my wrist and dragged me through the crowd. The host got the playlist going on the sound system, and as we disappeared into the belly of the yacht, Jerome said, "How do you think we did?" He checked to make sure his date wasn't listening, and when he looked away, I punched him in the thigh, saying, "You saw them dancing." Then Andy pinched Jerome on the cheek and led me into the ship, past the waiters, the crew, all too tipsy to care about our intrusion. We'd had sex in public before, in bathrooms at parties and backseats after shows, too ready to be home to actually make the drive. So when she unbound my belt and hopped onto the table in that dim-lit storage room, I wasn't alarmed. What I wanted was to satisfy the taste for thrills that propelled her. I used to think that was why she liked me, my ability to join her in risk. It wasn't the first time we failed to use a condom either. She looked me in the eye saying, "Don't you dare finish." It might have been that we drunk too much free booze that night, trying to make up for the light pay, or that the chop kept rocking the table into the wall, tilting me toward her. She made a sound low and intimate that when I opened my eyes to see her face soaked in amber light, I couldn't stop myself. She said, "Did you?" "Fuck, I'm sorry." The way she laughed helped soften my embarrassment. She hugged me, her arms over my shoulders, her hand gripping the length of my hair. She said, "I wondered what it would be like to date teenage you." I start to pull away from her, and she locked her fingers together behind my neck and said, "Stay. The damage is already done." She kissed me on the chin and pinched my hips with her thighs. I held her chest to me, could feel the confusing rhythm that her pulse layered in mine. I said, "I can pick one up tomorrow. I'll pay for it." "Sometimes you're too romantic for me. I'm just being practical." "Don't be practical while you're inside me." I touched my forehead to hers, dropped my hands to rest against the folds of her sundress bunched across her hips. She said, "Would it be the worst thing to have a little Asian baby?" "Don't fuck around. Jesus, why are you so ready to do away with it before it's even a problem?" The room swayed. I said, "I just thought we were on the same page about this." I was looking at the pair of moles on her sternum, and Andy tilted her head to try and meet my eyes. She said, "Just think about it for a second. Our beautiful little Asian baby. Stop doing that. Why is it so terrible to consider?" It's not that. Just stop qualifying it. You are Chinese. What else would it be? It would just be our kid. My kid. It can't be your kid without being that. Is that why you want it?" Under the deck, the feet stomping on the dance floor above sounded like they might cave the roof in. Andy slid away from me and pulled her skirt down around her knees. The current rocked my thighs into the edge of the table. She said, "Is that what you think?" There is an instant before my body rises when I'm still sitting on the lips of death, making fists in the black water. I'm not sinking, just listing in the stomach of the Chesapeake. The pressure of the bay pushes its fingers into my eardrums, the water past my throat, my stomach, my lungs. This is after the held breath panic, that first swallow and surrender. There is no boat, no coast or beach, pebbles strewn in gray. Up the way, that hand-me-down Corolla with its seats folded back will not be reloaded with my drums. I won't thank Andy for letting me drag her to another gig, and she won't tell me to stop apologizing for existing. I wonder if she ever had children. If she named one Theodore, even if he isn't mine. A thin strand of my thoughts reaching backward toward life, then. Thump! And the dull knock of knuckles to glass. I want just one more moment there. The image of Andy's curls tossing with the rhythm as she dances. But Benji won't leave. So I rise and heave, and the water laminates my hair about my face, drops of it studding my eyelids. He says, "Where have you been?" I fold my blazer, remove my shirt, climb free, and gather a ponytail behind my head, wringing it between my palms. I watch Benji help Roberta clear from her bath and touch Steve on the scalp as he runs off to play. Jessica and Vaughn, each with a baby, walk arm in arm through the channel. Water runs from the tips of my hair past the small of my back, and Benji says, "Let's go somewhere." He's asking me questions, but I don't feel like talking. We stop for a crowd of cruise wreck victims to move through an intersection, and Benji says, "Have I ever told you about my route?" Pulling on the wet horsetail of hair that falls between my shoulder blades, I shake my head. He says, "I delivered for most of Roland Park, Cold Spring to the lake. My mom had us in Patterson when I was young. I was used to that kind of Baltimore, the only foliage matted with dog piss and stubbed out cigarettes. Roland Park felt false to me. I mean, it's beautiful, don't get me wrong, all the grass and fat old trees, but you can feel the walls there, you know? You can't even hear the music of the streets just four blocks south. I didn't get into mail to schlep around the suburbs, dropping letters in decorative mailboxes. I wanted to meet people. I wanted a neighborhood. The only people I ever saw were kids playing in the yards. So one day, I park at the bottom of this cul-de-sac and deliver on foot. It was summer, and I was tired of being stuck in the van. Must have been 85 out. Sunlight playing in the trees was breathtaking. So I'm halfway back when I hear this little girl scream. Turns out the neighbor's chow got out and was biting her on the ankle. The dog's muzzle was this terrible color red. I take off my shoe and I'm hitting it on the head, but it wasn't letting go. She keeps screaming, so I gather my nerves up and reach into its mouth and pry its jaw off her ankle. Its teeth tore my fingers all up. By then, the girl's mother comes out of the house and the chow runs off. She's asking what happened, scooping her daughter up. It takes us a while for us to feel safe again. We're standing on the porch, and the daughter is just wailing. The mother thanks me, and this whole time, all I can feel is my fingers throbbing. I ended up getting 36 stitches over this. I keep picturing the dog's spit mixing in my wounds, and all I wanted to do was wash my hands off. So I ask if I can come in and use the bathroom. And sure, she let me. Benji stops, leaning against a pond thick with algae. The wrinkles in his forehead darken as he dips his head. "But she paused first," he says. I'm standing there with two palms full of blood, and she paused. Like she can't trust me. Just for an instant. I was in too much pain to let that settle in, but later, I don't know. It got to me. When I put my hand on his shoulder, I can feel the dried soup crusted like sand to his skin. I tell him, "Hey, when she tells that story about the mailman who saved her daughter, or when that girl grows up and she talks about the scar on her leg, you know they'll leave that part out." Then we're walking, and when we make a turn, the champagne is so bright, it looks like the sun itself kneeling at our feet. An older man in a halter top dress has a cigarette pinched between his lips and is spinning the wheel of a Zippo with his thumb. We lean over the glass, smelling the grapes, the too sweet perfume of fermentation. The bubbles whisper as they break the surface. Benji closes his eyes and smiles. In the middle of the pool, a blonde wig floats. Turning, he extends his hand. "You must be Wilhelm." Wilhelm takes Benji's hand, then runs his palm over the stubble on his scalp. Over his shoulder, I can see Roberta enter the channel. Her hair folded onto her collarbone, and at her side, Buckley is walking in nothing but his underwear and boots still thick with mud. He waves and says, "Hello, gentlemen." They join our circle, and Benji turns back to Wilhelm. "Please, you must tell us about yourself. We've all heard so many stories about you." Wilhelm takes the cigarette in his hand, regarding the soiled paper with a dissatisfaction that gives way suddenly to a chuckle and shake of his head, the kind of patience and grace reserved for mothers. Refitting it on his lip, he spins the metal wheel of the lighter with his thumb. He says, "I don't have any stories. I'm just waiting for the wick to dry."
This is David Edward Yee, and you've just heard my story, Heaven for Your Full Lungs. When I was 12 or 13, I had a dream similar to the world this story takes place in. The memory of it has always stuck with me, and a few years ago, I tried to create a short story based on it. I wrote a page, and I realized that while the setting was interesting, I didn't have a character. It wasn't until much, much later that I joined the world of this story with Thump and his narrative. And that process, the process of creating the story, is indicative of my writing process in general, which is to say, all of my work comes from the task of marrying an idea with a person. That idea, for me, isn't always something as grand as imagining heaven, but it usually does present itself as a challenge, something that seems almost impossible to pull off convincingly. I think it's dangerous to write short stories based on ideas for that reason. Ideas lack the human truth that is essential in a great story. The work for me becomes taking this idea and grounding it into the life of a character, giving it motivation and movement and meaning. The character has to rise to match or overshadow the idea, and until the two work in tandem, the story isn't finished. Thank you for listening.
You've just heard Heaven for Your Full Lungs by David E. Yee, read by Brandon Nakagaki. The Stories on Stage Davis podcast will be back with a new episode featuring a classic Christmas short story on Saturday, December 12th. In the meantime, we hope that you and your family stay healthy and safe, and that you'll tune in for our special December episodes. The Stories on Stage Davis podcast is a sponsored project of Yolo Arts, a nonprofit arts organization, and supported in part by a grant from the City of Davis Arts and Cultural Affairs Program. Find upcoming episodes, view our archive of past episodes, and help support our series at storiesonstagedavis.com.